Good morning to all of you. I have a question. Which chapter in 1 Corinthians, has a title or a name, and what is that title? Anyone have that? Up here, yes? The love chapter, and it's chapter 13, and you may turn to that chapter. The love chapter, and it's named the love chapter, obviously, because it is about love. It is about love. Chapter 13 is a song, actually, and it praises the supremacy of love as the greatest of the spiritual gifts in the church. And you might remember a couple months ago we looked at the gifts of the Spirit that Paul emphasizes in chapter 12. And now in chapter 13, he is making it clear that all the gifts of the Spirit, all the gifts are subordinate to the greatest gift, which is love. And that's the title today, Charity, the Greatest Gift. The New Testament uses two words, two Greek words for love, agape and phileo. And phileo is more of a brotherly friendship kind of love, something you would use if you were talking about being a good friend or a close friend with someone. You love someone. It could also mean showing a preference for something, like in Matthew 6, 5, where Jesus said the Pharisees love the corners of the streets or the special places in the synagogue because they could be seen of people. So it's used in that way. That's phileo. Agape actually was not used that much in Greek literature. It was a Greek word. In one case, I think it was used, to show divinity. But in the New Testament, it's used a lot. And its use in the New Testament really has shaped the meaning of the word because it's used to show true self-sacrificing love. And agape is the word that's used consistently throughout this chapter. This love is not new to us, is it? Because Jesus lived and died as our true example of agape love. And he told his disciples before he went back to heaven, he said, his followers would be known by their love for each other. His disciples would be known by that. This love comes as a direct result of our relationship with God. And so we'll be talking today about what this love looks like. But remember, it's not something that we just have because we have that special personality or because we've sort of disciplined ourselves to be this way. It has to come from the inside and then work its way out. And the only way to get it there is to get or experience that love from Christ. In the Old Testament, the Shema reminds us to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And Jesus reiterated this in his teaching when he said, there's a second commandment that's like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so here in 1 Corinthians 13, we have the Apostle Paul just kind of bursting out in this poetic praise, speaking eloquently and descriptively of this greatest gift. And today we want to take a look at this rich depiction of Christian love and reflect on how this love works its way out into our everyday living. Let's read chapter 13, 1 Corinthians, verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I'm become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my gifts, all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child, and I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I also am known. And now abideth faith, hope, and charity. These three, but the greatest of these is charity. It's a beautiful piece. I'd like to look briefly at the structure because this really is a piece of poetry. And it's fitting that we treat with special care something that is the greatest of the gifts, the characteristic that Christ followers are actually to be known by. And so let's look at how this begins. The basic structure, we have these three rhetorical statements. We don't expect a reply. They're just there. And he basically says, you have eloquent speech. And of course, he's speaking of tongues. He's just mentioned that in chapter 12. And apparently the Corinthians thought tongues was a greatest gift. He's saying, you can have eloquent speech. You can speak in many tongues. It can even have an angelic quality to it. And the thought here is that some people were so eloquent, it was like they had just received their words from the gods. Angelic or not, if there's no love, it's empty words. If you can have great understanding, knowledge, faith, spiritual insight, but without charity, not worth much. You can even give generously. You can give the ultimate of your life and your body, but without love, it's simply a waste. So these rhetorical statements. And then he starts in with these descriptors of charity. And I think of them as a positive and negative. So he starts out with saying what charity is, and then he says what it's not. And so we have it's patient, it's kind, doesn't envy, doesn't boast. These are other words for some of the King James here. It isn't arrogant. It's not rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. I hope this is kind of connecting with us. It doesn't insist on its own way. It's not irritable. It's not resentful. And then he goes into a contrast. I'm looking at verse 6. Rejoicing not in iniquity, but rejoicing in the truth. And then we have a list here. He's just waxing eloquent with this symmetrical wording. Uses the word all four times in a row. Bears all things. That speaks of patience. Believes all things. Hopes all things. Endures all things. All of this is in the context of relationships with people. And we'll talk more about that later. Then he compares with the gifts that he's been talking about in chapter 12. And he actually references those three in his opening rhetorical statements. Tongues, prophecy, knowledge. So here in verse 8, charity never fails. It lasts forever. But prophecies, they will fail. Tongues, we won't need those anymore. Knowledge, we're not going to need that either. Love will follow us into eternity. And then the rest, he's saying, in other words, we have knowledge, and it's useful for us today. We know in part, but we prophesy with, in other words, we have foresight, we can foretell. There are people that are truth tellers. They can give us something to contemplate and think about as we look into the future. But at some point, that's going to be unnecessary, and yet love will carry on. Then he uses this characteristic. When I was a child, I spake as a child, etc. Maybe I'll just kind of pass over that. We'll come back to that in a little more detail later on. But he ends by saying, love is surpassing all of these. And I'd like us to just keep in mind that just in structure, he is thinking of some of the best of the gifts, which are the tongues, as the Corinthians felt were important, prophecy and knowledge, which have to do with revelation. And yet he's saying, even those, love is greater. A time will come when all will be fully known, even as we are fully known. And the implication is, at that point, we will be experiencing love. The rest of the time, I would like to look at what it means to live this passage. What does it mean to really love? And what does that love really look like? I feel like I am talking to myself. And it's not because you're sleeping, because you're not. It's because everything I say, it feels like I need to admit that I need to hear this first. And I just am not a person that is naturally unselfish and that naturally loves unconditionally. And I think many of us can identify with that. There are just things about us and how we live and what we want in life that have a lot to do with us. And a lot of what we say, what we do, choices we make, just tend to be centered about what we want, who we are, what we want to become, how we want to be portrayed to other people. It's so easy to be selfish. Love is not selfish. So think with me. We love people who are eloquent, who can express themselves so well. We like the folks with that special insight. They've analyzed, they've thought about, they understand. We like people, possibly, that are highly educated. We have people that we look up to. You can fill in the blank in your mind. Who are those people? But we look up to them. We may admire those who have a dauntless faith. Those who give and give and give until they're gone. But if love doesn't motivate what we do, if it doesn't motivate what we pursue, our words fall short. The insight that we give feels egotistical. The education, the knowledge that we acquire is meaningless. And the faith that's so strong is not maybe really faith at all. And self-sacrifice, the giving and giving, has simply been a waste. You see, true love, sacrificial love, adds value. In fact, it adds meaning to all that we do. Love gives us purpose, and it lies at the heart of motivation. Love motivates what we do. Because if we truly love God and love other people, we're motivated to give our lives unselfishly to Him and to others. Understanding God's love for us, even though we don't deserve it, understanding God's love for us, even when we don't deserve it, prompts us to give others the love that we've been given. And we can give because we have received. I want to stop and think about that last statement. We can give because we've received. How many of us, I'm sure pretty much all of you could raise your hand, but have you felt or come to a place where you felt you could give no more? Come to a place where you could give no more. I think Jesus probably felt his human limitations as well. But you know, that is a sign it's time to get away, to spend time with God, reflecting on our sinfulness apart from God's saving grace and the love and mercy that he's given to us even so. In other words, I want to be sure that we're thinking of love in tandem, kind of in alongside of God's holiness and his righteousness, because love actually doesn't carry a lot of substance unless love is being given when it's undeserved. If love is being given and we don't deserve it, that prompts true sacrificial love to give to other people. And so we can't conjure this up. We have to take the love from Christ and allow it to flow through us. We get a fresh glimpse of God's love and his mercy on us. And then we're able to share with others in the big and small ways that come to us in a day. Think about it. A smile, an ear, an encouraging word. It could be a well-fitted rebuke, a hug. It could be a tear or a gift or an act of kindness. It could be as subtle or not so subtle as a life that speaks of integrity. It could be a tall moral stance, someone who's not dipping to the low expectations of society. And the love of God just spreads out about us in these concentric waves that one after the other are reminders to everyone that comes in contact with us of God's righteousness, his mercy, and his love. It might be helpful for you just to look at chapter 13. We're going to be looking at these definitions of love, verses 4 and following, as I kind of talk through these. What does this look like? It could be characterized in many ways. And Paul poetically begins with this. Patient. Why is it so hard to sit and wait on others? That's incredibly difficult. I am not a patient person. I see myself as very impatient, and it's not a secret in my family that I've caused some stress over the impatience that they've seen. I simply hate delays. I like to get stuff done. I like to get it done efficiently. I want the task list. I want people that are productive. I want people that can say they use their time well. Not that I always use mine well, but I like to see people that way. And it's hard to wait. But impatience at its root really is selfish. It's focused inward with little regard for how others are getting along, little regard for a potential disaster or a very difficult situation that someone else besides you may be experiencing. And it doesn't really think about or ask the question, what does God want to teach me in the waiting? What is there for me to learn while I am waiting? It doesn't ask God for priorities for the day. Instead, it's looking at me and what I feel should be accomplished. But love is patient. It waits. Love is also kind. Ephesians 4:32, be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. Again, why are we kind? Because we've seen God's kindness, we've experienced God's kindness to us. It's the only way we can offer it. Kindness comes from a heart of gratitude for this kindness offered to us. And we feel like being nice. The feeling actually comes when we stop to realize God and other people have been nice to us. Entitlement is a word that's thrown around today. When people realize that they're not entitled to the good life. We're not entitled to have everybody treat us with respect and dignity. We're not necessarily entitled to have everyone say nice words to us. I mean, in a perfect world, right? But sorry, that's long been gone. And the reality is that we live in a world where people are mean, where people disdain others, where people are rude and crude, and we're not guaranteed that we're not going to bear the brunt of those things. But we have experienced kindness, and this kindness has come to us when we did not deserve it. Not a one of us deserves any act of kindness that we have received. Us bearing kindness, giving kindness to others is just our duty. It's the best that we can do because of what God has given to us. We should say, thank you, Jesus, a lot more. And we should really, really mean it. So love is kind. Love is not envious. Isn't it easy to resent those who are more popular than we are? They can speak better than we can. They have nicer cars. They have newer phones, better jobs, more children, fewer children, better families, cool shoes, more money. They're happily married, or they're free and single. Or they have the luxury of a trip to Europe. And the list goes on. It's so easy to look around. Look around and what others have and forget what we have. Love looks at others and is happy for the success that they have. Happy for the things that they've got. And we want in that love for them to be able to use all that they've been given for the glory of God. Love is not envious. Love doesn't boast. It's not arrogant. Boasting and arrogance come from a heart that's self-centered again. A proud person compares constantly. He's comparing his or her actions and accomplishments to those far and near and constantly assessing personal status in relation to those things. When the assessment seems good, all is great, and others aren't performing like they should. Why doesn't everyone else do what I'm doing? Why doesn't everybody else be what I am? is kind of the attitude we can tend to take. When the assessment or the comparison with others is putting us in a bad light, all is horrible, and others are making it difficult for us to be the best. Pride is so selfish, and yet it is so close to us. I mean, it's so easy for thoughts of pride just to sneak in at the most inopportune times. Times when we are sincere and really motivated by a heart of love, and suddenly there's that thought of, I sure hope someone's watching, or I've got my charity marked off for the week, or it goes on. It's just, I want us to realize that we really wrestle with this. We tend to be proud people. I don't like to be wrong. I don't like to be inferior. I don't like to be left behind. I don't like to be unpopular. I don't want to be seen as ignorant. But I'm probably all those things. It's okay. I don't know everything. I probably should know a lot more than I do. If I let those thoughts dictate my actions, I can be a very difficult person to live with. You know, God has a way of kind of working with us. He allows circumstances to help us see our dependence on Him and other people. And boy, isn't that a tonic for pride. When you don't have anything to offer, there's nothing you can do that'll fix it. Or your health is taken away. The money's run out. There are no words to say that are going to fix this. All of those things, and you are probably thinking of things in your own life, but there are times and there are ways that God brings us to the end of ourselves and kind of, I guess, figuratively at least, allows us to fall on our face, and then we're in a good position to love. So love is not proud or arrogant. Love is not rude. When we love others, we try to show courtesy and good manners. We don't do things that would aggravate, be distasteful, or show disdain to other people. We take good care of others, and we show respect. That's why we hold doors for people. That's why we say good morning, even if we don't feel like it. That's why we don't bring our phones to the table, maybe. And that's why crude and rude is not loving. I think families struggle with this, actually. Families can, if allowed to, can normally relate to each other in crude and rude ways. And I'm not trying to, you know, set up a perfect model of a family, because we sure don't have one. But I am saying that some of our families could probably leave some crude and rude out and learn to relate on more wholesome levels. And it would be a good start in learning to relate well to others as well. Love is not rude. Love is not always right. It's okay to admit we're wrong, but it's so, so difficult, particularly if it's something we have worked hard at, we have thought about, and then somebody says, yeah, but did you think about that? I mean, and I disagree with you. You're actually wrong. Why is it so hard to accept that we might be wrong? I mean, who of us hasn't been wrong at some point in our life? Is this like something that's not actually human, where people don't make mistakes, and we happen to be the one person that makes a mistake? Some of us live that way. There's a name for them. They're called perfectionists and idealists and probably some other terms. We have to be okay with making mistakes. Some people imagine, they have the delusion that they could get everything right, and it hurts their ego to admit they didn't get it. Admitting mistakes requires us to listen to others. It requires us to learn from others rather than imagining we have learned everything ourselves or somehow done it all independently. Yesterday, I took a break from sermon prep. It actually wasn't going the best. And I walked over to our farm meat store, and there were several customers there. I hadn't really planned to help anybody, but there they were. So I helped one person check out buying some eggs. And he kind of matter-of-factly told me, I think it might have been his first time there, but he matter-of-factly told me that the eggs that we had marked large were not large. In other words, they were smaller than large. Now, I informed him that actually they were probably extra large, because that's sort of what our chickens are laying right now. I could have taken them back and weighed them or looked up online again to see exactly what the number of grams is for measuring all that, but I didn't. I think I was courteous, but what I thought about as I went back is just how much that ground me. I mean, for crying out loud, we don't sell medium eggs for large price. We just don't do those things. But what was the angst, or what was that irritated feeling that I felt, and why? I don't always have to be right, and we could have made a mistake. Love doesn't always have to be right. Love is not irritable. If we find ourselves irritable, we need to take a break and sit at God's feet and listen. Again, it's confession for me. Yesterday, I walked into the house, and I didn't even think what I was doing, but the first words out of my mouth were a reprimand towards someone for something that had been forgotten. Fortunately for them, I think, I walked quickly through the kitchen, went down to the basement to get started on some things, and that was when my dear wife met me down there before I'd done more verbal damage and tried to help me understand how I was sounding to the family. You know, I need to realize that I can take out my frustrations on other people. And it's not fair, and it's not nice. It's not fair, and it's not nice. It'd be better for me to get away, get some things fixed, and then be in a better frame of mind for my family. Love is not irritable. Love is not resentful. Resentment isn't loving because it keeps an account. And actually, the word here refers to keeping an account of wrongs. Now, I don't know if any of us would actually keep a diary and work this out, but maybe we don't write these things down, but some of us might. But it is alarming to me sometimes how that when I might meet somebody that I thought I'd forgiven, that suddenly there are these things that pop up in my mind. Anybody identify with that? It's just kind of this, whoops, there it is. And then at that moment, I'm given the opportunity to forgive again and lay it down. Resentment builds. Bitterness follows when we keep an account, or we feel like that person deserves to give us something because of something we've given to them. Love gives and doesn't expect it in return. So love does not resent or keep account. Love doesn't rejoice at wrong. Instead, it rejoices in truth. We have grown up ways of sometimes rejoicing at wrong. It may come out like, he got what he deserved, and with that self-satisfied tone of voice. But even if we don't say it, we might find ourselves feeling smug when someone's life takes a turn for the worse because we gave them advice, they didn't follow it. We had told them so. I mean, if we're really mature, we for sure won't say, I told you so. I mean, that's even less mature to say, I told you so. But thinking it as well puts us in the frame of mind that makes it difficult for us to reach out to those people in love. On the flip side, we're not living in love either if we support and go after that which is wrong, or if we encourage people to do wrong, or you could say if we don't intervene and let them know that they're doing something wrong. Let's not just think of love as being this mercy-laden kind of presentation. It's also very tough at times. And yet that toughness isn't irritable. It's not rude. And then beareth, believeth, hopeth, endureth. All of these are communicating a little different aspect of love. I think of the verse, love shall cover the multitude of sins. It's 1 Peter 4:8. We're called to suffer long or to bear. And that word beareth actually sounds like cover with silence. We're supposed to cover with silence sometimes. Bear with people. Maybe not say the things that we want to say and that maybe should be said at some time, at some point. But because the time is not right, we hold it back and don't say it. Love has that capability. Love believes. It trusts or thinks the best of others. Even if they're making poor choices, it hopes for the best. It tries to have fortitude and perseverance in relationships, like endureth all things. Often we stop much too early in pursuing each other's hearts. Because that's really, really difficult. It's really hard to sit down with somebody, take the time, and ask them the difficult questions in a sincere and loving way. It's much easier just to say, well, you made your bed, just lie in it and suffer. Love pursues people, but this takes time, thought, and much prayer. The last part of the chapter, now, he simply is reiterating that love is the greatest. It never fails. This contrasts with prophecies, with speaking in tongues and acquiring knowledge. But at some point, those will go, love will be all that's needed. And Paul compares this incomplete understanding, if you look at verses 9 and following, compares this incomplete understanding with the mindset of a child. A child doesn't understand everything, doesn't know everything. But when manhood comes, when adulthood comes, we now can speak on an adult level. We can analyze and rationalize. We can compare and contrast. We can see trends and cause and effect. We can clearly understand our hearts, or more clearly understand our heart motivations. And in the same way, love is a gift that will last all eternity and is more important than all the other gifts. He compares it to a mirror as well. Remember, mirrors in that day were made out of polished brass. So the image that you're getting is not the clear image that we get in mirrors today. And he's saying, now we're looking through a mirror, and that image is somewhat obscure. But there will be a time when it will be clear, and it's going to be because we will understand love, we will love purely, and we will experience love in a way we have never experienced it before. It's kind of a wonderful thought, really. Faith, hope, and love get a lot of attention in Paul's epistles. They are all a part of the Christian experience, but he closes with this reminder that love is the greatest gift. And so we've looked at this classic poem, lifting high the virtue of love. It's easy to think that this is a standard or way of life that's impossible to live. It's a little bit the feeling I had as I worked over this. I mean, can I do this? I don't know. Can we do this? But we need to remember that we can't do it on our own. If we're not experiencing God's love in our hearts, there really is no way that we can expect true love to be flowing out to other people. We love him because he first loved us, 1 John 4:19. And we experience his love as we give ourselves to him and surrender. It's a giving up. It's an open hand. Fear, control, they grasp. They clench. They grab. They take away. But love opens up. Love gives. Love doesn't worry about things. It doesn't have to control the outcomes. It's a surrender. Could you, with me just a little bit, could you hold your hands out in front of you? This is your personal decision. But if you're going to love, you're going to have to let go. You're going to have to surrender. And if we resist God, he still loves us. He's still waiting for us to come. But we cannot offer his love to other people until we have experienced his love ourselves. We will continue to wrestle and live out of our selfish hearts, and the people around us will continue to suffer as we cut ourselves off from our own Creator and the one who wants so badly to redeem us. Are we afraid to surrender? Do we have fear? There's no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. Let's pray. Father, we come to you. We recognize that love is something that is so evasive. It's not in us. And yet you have shown us the way by giving your Son. You've forgiven us when we didn't deserve to be forgiven. You love us unconditionally even when we walk away from you. I ask that if there's anyone here, and it's all of us in many ways, that is tending to resist you, that we would open up and we would extend our hands. We would let go of the grasp that we have, and we would trust you. We would let go of control. We would not be fearful but trusting. Help us, Father. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.